it was very interesting to see how while the United States and Israel were attacking Iran, there were no manifestations outside. You didn't see images of Muslims across the board basically calling a resistance against the Zionist entity or something. It didn't happen. I think that people underestimate how important that is for the Islamic Republic because it's a revolutionary regime. I think they spent it. It's just not attractive anymore. Being part of Hezbollah militias is just not it. It's very funny because now they're more attractive in the West than in the East. China has built up Iran's arsenal, militarily speaking. When it comes to the chemicals they've been sending to Iran, it is really thanks to China that the Islamic Republic has now a huge amount of missiles.
Hey, Asher.
Hey, love.
Have you ever heard of the Paul is dead conspiracy theory?
Nope, I don't think so.
In 1969, someone came up with a conspiracy theory that Paul McCartney of the Beatles is actually dead. And they came up with different proofs of this over time, like that the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, you know what I'm talking about, with all the people, is a funeral for Paul.
Okay.
And on the Abbey Road cover where the Beatles are all crossing the street, Paul is barefoot. Mm-hmm. And you don't bury a corpse with shoes, apparently, something like that. A lot of different theories about why Paul McCartney is actually dead and the person we think who Paul is, Paul McCartney, is an imposter. Do you know where I'm going with this?
I can guess.
So the internet thinks that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is dead. They think every new video that he puts out is AI. He keeps putting out videos joking about this, showing him that he has five fingers, you know, because a lot of times like AI messes up people's hands. And I mean, I'm sure he's alive. I'm very sure he's alive. The weird thing is that the rumor started last week. I think it was Thursday night when he gave a video statement to the press, and they're like, well, why isn't he out and about? Why isn't he doing things live? First of all, like, he has been doing things live. They claimed he was killed in Beit Shemesh. He wasn't killed in Beit Shemesh. He was visiting the site of a missile impact in Beit Shemesh, which was basically the worst tragedy of this war so far. But back to that statement to the press, what they don't know or what they didn't pay attention to is that at the end of it, there was an actual press conference with journalists asking questions. Now, it was on Zoom. It wasn't in person. And I was unable to attend on Zoom and all that, but like, I know the Israeli press corps. They wouldn't be in on a conspiracy to prop Bibi up and pretend he's alive with fake questions and answers. Like, these are real people, and I hear their voices. Like, I'm friends with some of them, you know? I would know their voices anyway.
And there's no doubt that the Israeli media also is very dedicated and committing to keeping Netanyahu as prime minister for as long as possible.
Oh, yeah.
So they would do whatever they could to, you know, keep up the image of him still
right,
being
exactly.
around.
Like, at this point, I just think it's really funny, actually, because people have, like, some of the dumbest, like, really, really dumbest theories. Like, it's as dumb as, you know, thinking that Paul McCartney's been dead for the past 55 years.
It's remarkable. You know, it's you see the power of social media where this thing gets, you know, said over and over again, and people who, I don't know if you'd call them serious people, but who are considered, you know, by mainstream media in America, people like Mehdi Hasan, right, who are, you know, raising the possibility that, wait a second, this might actually be true. It just shows the power of
I didn't even see Mehdi Hasan did it.
Yeah, he said, I don't want to be conspiracy theorist, but wow, this really looks like AI. Look, maybe it has to do with the fact that we have lasers that can shoot down drones. We have exploding beepers. You know, people say, okay, well, then why can't they have an AI prime minister? The Startup Nation could probably pull that off. So maybe that's part of it.
You know, today when we're recording, it's Tuesday, the Prime Minister's office put out a photo of him giving the command to kill Ali Larijani, the head of the National Security Council of Iran. We'll discuss that a little more soon. But in the picture, certain things on his desk were blurred out. And so people were like, this is definitely AI. Like, they've been doing that forever because they don't want you to see classified documents or to like zoom in and see like, I don't know, the serial number on his tablet so that you could hack into it or whatever, you know, like they've been blurring things in pictures forever. It's just everyone's just looking to, you know, It's wishful thinking by these people, of course.
But can you see, because you live not too far away from Tel Aviv, can you see the big gaping crater where Tel Aviv used to stand now that it's been entirely wiped from the face of the earth?
Oh, yeah. I live by this hill where there's a road down the hill that goes down the hill. And from the top of it, you can see the Tel Aviv skyline. And it's all been erased now. It's all exactly the same as it's always been.
I would like to inform our listeners that Tel Aviv is still standing and Benjamin Netanyahu is still alive. That's our breaking news for today.
Yes, yes. Newsflash.
The news about the elimination of Ali Larijani is remarkable for two reasons. First of all, the fact that he knew that he was very high on Israel's target list. He was in America's target list. He was doing the best he could to remain hidden. The reports are that the intelligence was obtained, and within a very short amount of time, Israel sent off a plane to eliminate him. When you send off a plane, it's one thing to send off a plane to Gaza because you've just spotted a terrorist. But here we sent off a plane over Syria, over Iraq, to Tehran, to Iran, to eliminate a terrorist. And that's just another level of capabilities. Ali Larijani, his official title was Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. But in practice, he was in some ways the de facto leader of Iran since Ali Khamenei was eliminated at the first minute of the war. He's a crucial bridge between the military and political leaderships in Iran. And his elimination, I think, is going to both degrade Iran's ability to sort of centrally control what's happening, and also probably is going to further weaken the political leadership and further strengthen the military, the generals, the heads of the IRGC, who are seems to be really calling the shots now.
At the same time, you know, there's the official supreme leader of Iran, who's, you know, Mujtaba Khamenei, really not great with pronouncing these names. Yeah. And nobody has seen him live. There's all kinds of rumors about his condition. I've seen some that he was like his face is all scarred from wounds, or that he's actually a vegetable and isn't actually the leader of it. He doesn't even know he's supreme leader, but it's clear that something's going on. Oh, and of course, at the ceremony where they declared him supreme leader, they brought a cardboard cutout of him, which honestly looks like something out of South Park.
Look, some countries have their leaders as AI, and some countries have their leaders as cardboard, you know, everybody with their capabilities.
Exactly. It's interesting. I mean, like, who's really in charge right now? I mean, maybe we'll find out in a couple of days, but I think that right now, the Iranian leadership must be flailing to figure that out.
Absolutely. And I actually think we're going to see a more rapid disintegration than people even assume. I think we're going to see, and there are already reports of military units and members of the besieged paramilitary repression units who are refusing to go out and fire missiles because they know that they're going to be picked off very quickly. And I think we're going to see that more and more. That doesn't mean that there still won't be units that are capable of firing missiles and drones. There's been much less activity over eastern Iran than over the western or southern Iran. It's farther away, but they could move potentially missiles from their capabilities from there into western Iran, where they could then be fired at Israel or at U.S. Installations. Or what we've seen to date, which is the firing of missiles and drones at 11 different Muslim and Arab countries. I mean, it's amazing. Iran has fired over 4,000, probably substantially over 4,000 missiles and drones since the beginning of this operation. We don't know the exact numbers, but between 75 to 80% of them were fired not at Israel, but at Arab and Muslim countries.
And the country that they fired at the most is the UAE, more than Israel.
Absolutely. Which I think is going to, the UAE has their interception rates for missiles has been about 99%, and for drones has been about 94%. You can see that they prepared for this eventuality. I don't think anybody really thought that the attack would be this intensive.
It's good to be friends with Israel.
Well, yeah, and we know for sure that it's not a secret that Israeli Barak missiles are part of the air defense around Abu Dhabi, along with American and other kinds of systems. And I think going forward, this is also going to lead to greater cooperation between the countries.
Netanyahu has said it a couple times that countries that Israel does not have relations with have reached out to Israel since the beginning of the war, and that he thinks there's potential for it to grow into something else. And I mean, frankly, the Abraham Accords grew out of contacts between Israel and those countries that admired the way Netanyahu and others in Israel were standing up to Iran. And so I think that that makes sense that there would be potential for more of that to happen after this war. It would be nice, though, to see more of these countries stepping up, you know, and doing more as part of the war effort. I mean, we see now President Trump is calling for more countries to help ensure the Straits of Hormuz remain open. It's been a few days since Iran has actually attacked ships, from what I saw that today. I admit I'm not tracking what they're attacking day to day in terms of ships, but my understanding is that it's actually been a few days. But to keep it open and to ensure that they don't keep doing it, President Trump wants the help of other countries also to escort oil tankers through the straits. And it seems like there are no takers other than Israel, which is crazy because neither the U.S. nor Israel actually gets its oil through the Straits of Hormuz, as far as I understand. If Israel does, then it's indirectly. So I don't know why these countries are not acting in their self-interest. It's not like they're immune from Iran and Iran loves them so much and won't attack them.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think a lot of Israel's oil is coming from Central Asia. It's not transiting through the Straits of Hormuz. And of course, Israel has its own natural gas. President Trump has expresses very, very deep disappointment with NATO and all the NATO countries, the fact that none of them are really willing to stand up and help. I think he's also seen how useless the UN is, both in this instance and also around Gaza. And I think it points the direction of part of his vision of the Board of Peace, which we've discussed previously, but being more than just about Gaza. I think this is going to be further impetus for, you know, if he's very frustrated that the U.S. is investing so much in NATO, and then when the U.S. asks them for help in an area that's eventually supposed to help them as well, there's a refusal to take part. I think we're going to see President Trump also embracing new multilateral institutions and frameworks under American leadership, partly also because of the experience of none of these countries stepping up.
I mean, maybe, but it's not like the Board of Peace countries are stepping up either, right? Like some of them are defending themselves through their own missile defense systems, you know, that they've got from Israel and from other countries, but they're not helping in the Strait of Hormuz as far as we know.
That's true. So far, my estimation is that the GCC countries, if and when they believe that the Iran regime really is on its last legs, then they actually will decide to participate in the offensive actions. As long as they're concerned that there may be an end to this operation where the regime or the IRGC is still controlling the country and, you know, America and Israel take a step back and they're, you know, left right across the strait or in close proximity to this wounded and vindictive regime, then they're going to continue to hesitate and can continue to maintain their defensive posture. I think it's just important to take a step back and, you know, in a sense, because of America and Israel's unbelievable achievements time and time again, it almost becomes, you know, normalized. You know, when you hear this five times a day, you see these news that there is a massive Israeli air formation that is flying over Syria and Iraq into the heart of Tehran to pinpoint bomb leaders that are hiding underground and checkpoints set up by internal repression services. The fact that American Israeli pilots are flying side by side, the incredibly close cooperation on intelligence, on operations, on logistics, you know, almost the fact that, okay, we got Haniya, we got Sinwar, we got Nasrallah, we got the guy who replaced Nasrallah, we got Khamenei. Okay, so we also got Larijani. You know, I also heard an interesting statistic that the amount of material damage that Iran has managed to wreck on Israel in the current operation is about 10% of what they managed to do to Israel in June during the 12-day war. So that has to do also with the fact that they're firing at 11 other Arab and Muslim countries, but also has to do with the fact the efficiency and the effectiveness of Israel's defensive and offensive operations. And I think, you know, in the day-to-day, and we have our kids at home and there are sirens, but take a step back and say it's remarkable, and it's the fact that it's unremarkable has made it even more remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of like us being at home and with the kids, everything. Like I have friends from abroad who, you know, have like checked in on me and they're asking how I'm doing and whatever. And I'm like, it's utter chaos. I'm losing my mind. But also, this had to happen. Like, this had to happen, and it was going to have a price. There's no free lunches. And I think a lot of Israelis feel like this, that we're willing to pay that price. We realize that important things are happening for our national security. And in that vein, I also want to talk about Lebanon, where nothing's been announced officially, but it looks like Israel's gearing up for a broader ground invasion, perhaps more similar to what we saw at the end of 2023. So far, they've been what they've called limited incursions, where they've gone in to specific targets and then left, and that has continued. But we've seen some hints. Defense Minister Katz talked about basically doing in Lebanon what Israel did in parts of Gaza. You mentioned before Israel eliminating Nasrallah. We had that, legendary exploding pagers operation. But Hezbollah has been rebuilding. The Lebanese government and army has shown that it is incapable and quite possibly unwilling to actually disarm Hezbollah. The military especially is infiltrated at very high levels by people who are Hezbollah sympathizers. Nobody's going to do the job except for Israel. I've been saying this about Gaza all along, but I believe it as well about Lebanon. And Israel needs to do the job, or at least do something more significant than I think where the ceasefire left off at the end of 2024, which we should remind our listeners was something that came under pressure from the Biden administration. Although the Trump administration, that didn't exist yet. So the Trump transition team, they supported it, but it was insufficient, clearly. And something has to be done to keep Hezbollah away from the border. Now, the concern, and I wrote an analysis about this for Jewish Insider that people can also look up if they want to read it, is about Lebanon turning into a quagmire, right? Because Lebanon, in a way, was Israel's Vietnam War or its Afghanistan War. Like, the 1982 Lebanon War ended with Israel occupying southern Lebanon for 18 years, right? And what are the alternatives to that in order to keep Hezbollah away from the border? I want to hear your thoughts, and then I'll tell you what I heard from another analyst that I thought was interesting.
Absolutely. As I've spoken about on this podcast, I served in the last Lebanon ground operation. There's a possibility that I could be called up again this time if there is another extended ground operation. It has not happened yet, but it could happen. And as I may have mentioned, I experienced very, from very close proximity, we had driven Hezbollah out of one village, and we knew they were serving the next village over. And there was a debate for a couple of days while we were in Lebanon, are we continuing to that next village over? And the decision was made not to continue. And our commanding officers explained that one of the key considerations was concern over whether there'd be enough munitions and enough equipment given the de facto boycott that the Biden administration was placing on Israel, the sort of the slowdown of the shipments or the cancellation of shipments. And you know, we captured Hezbollah weapons and destroyed them, but there's obviously quite a lot more to do. There is a concern, I think, of dividing our attention. I mean, we have this historic opportunity in Iran, whether or not it makes sense to divert resources, we have to, defensive resources, there's no choice because Hezbollah is firing at us. To what extent it makes sense to divert substantial resources from Iran to Lebanon is a question. I think there's a good argument to be made for staying focused on Iran and only later moving to Hezbollah. The misconception that we had Macron decide to swoop in and offer to stop Israel's ground operation and facilitate negotiations between Lebanon and Israel. And Dr. Adi Schwartz, together with Dr. Einat Wilf, put out a Miskavenitsa 2 paper today saying, we don't need Macron. We don't need third parties. Israel is a sovereign country. Lebanon should be treated like a sovereign country. If it really wants to create relations to do effective military operations against Hezbollah, we can meet tomorrow at Rosh HaNikra. We don't need any European mediators. And if they're really serious.
Does anyone need Macron, really?
Exactly. I think Trump might have to scale down his 8 out of 10 rating he gave him.
Yeah, that was surprising to me.
I think you're absolutely right. The big part of the problem is the Lebanese armed forces. But if Lebanon is serious, let's have the head of the Lebanese army and the head of the IDF sit down and work together on a joint operational plan to defeat Hezbollah. As long as Lebanon keeps dragging, makes declarations, but is either, like you said, unwilling or unable to actually take care of, let's say tomorrow Lebanon recognizes Israel, right? Hezbollah still exists. Hezbollah is still firing at Israel. It doesn't solve the problem. So I think you're right. I think eventually, whether now or in a few months from now, Israel is going to have to solve the problem itself.
Yeah, and I think that, any day now, we'll see the beginning of that. So we have a really great guest coming up. But before we get into that, we are the Misgav Mideast Horizons podcast, the official podcast of the Misgav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host and a senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute for National Security and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Each week here at Mideast Horizons, we try to cut through the noise and the headlines to bring you fresh insights onto the most important issues that are taking place now in Israel and the Middle East. And obviously, there's no shortage of critical issues on the national security agenda right now.
Please subscribe and follow whatever we're doing to keep up to date on what's going on in the Middle East. And you can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
Please follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, wherever you get your social media. And if you like this podcast, if you find it valuable, please share it with friends or colleagues or whoever might benefit from deeper insights into the Middle East. This week's guest is Zineb Ribua. Zineb is a research fellow at Hudson Institute's Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East, where she focuses on the role of China and Russia in the Middle East, the impact of great power competition in the region, North Africa, Morocco, the Sahel, and developments there, and Arab-Israeli relations. Prior to joining the Hudson Institute, she did research at the Center for Jewish Civilization at Georgetown University, where she focused on the Moroccan-Israeli relations, Jewish identity in Morocco, and the cultural impact of the Abraham Accords. Her commentary and publications have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Policy, the Fox News, and many other prominent publications. Zineb was born in Morocco, studied in France, and then did her Master's of Public Policy at Georgetown University. And in this conversation, we go deep into the role that great power competition is playing in influencing and shaping the war in Iran, the impact of the war on the Middle East, on the future of the Abraham Accords, what an Abraham Accords 2.0 might look like, on the current status of Morocco-Israel relations and the potential for Morocco's role in advancing de-radicalization and tolerance here in the region, including possibly in Gaza. And we also talk about some of the conspiracy theories that are running wild now in the Arab world, in America, and online. So without further ado, stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Zineb Ribua. Zineb Ribua, welcome to Misgav Mideast Horizons.
Well, thank you very much, Asher and Laha, for having me.
It's great to have you, and I know we've both been following your work for a while, so it's great to have you on the show. For those who aren't familiar, can you give us a little bit about your personal background?
I'm Zineb Ribua. I'm a research fellow here at Hudson. I work at the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East, and I mainly work on Iran, China, Russia, great power competition in the region, and I've been tracking that for quite a while. I'm originally from Morocco, so... Yes, I speak French and Arabic, I've studied in France and then came here to the United States for my degree, and I loved being here since then.
You have argued that Operation Epic Fury, as the U.S. has called the war in Iran, is really about China. Can you sort of lay out that argument for our listeners?
Yeah, of course. I made that argument because I thought that it's an angle that is rarely explored and that deserves a lot of attention for three main reasons. The first one being that China has built up Iran's arsenal, militarily speaking, when it comes to the chemicals they've been sending to Iran. The cooperation that they have with the Islamic Republic has been extensive to the point where it is really thanks to China that the Islamic Republic has now a huge amount of missiles. So there is a pure military aspect there that is very...
When you say chemicals, you mean the chemicals that are needed for the fuel?
Yes. But also because Iran is heavy on the petrochemicals and not on others that are necessary for some other weapon systems, China has been very useful. And And so there's a military aspect. There's also the surveillance aspect of it. As you know, the Islamic Republic replaced its system from GPS to, I think, Beidou, something which is a Chinese system. They're very heavy on surveillance because they took a lot of the those surveillance facial recognition systems from China, and China was very happy to provide that because it's about also exporting its model and surveillance model. So there is this aspect that I think is quite important. The second one is that China has always been interested in the Middle East in terms of trade, in terms of getting closer to U.S. allies. It's a very important market in terms of resources and other things. And Iran obviously plays a big role in that. I mean, Tehran is definitely part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And so for China is also obviously having access to that type of market, especially that it's under sanctions. I think that's a very important point. The other one, the last thing I would say is that Tehran is precisely because it is under sanctions, it needs to do and it needs to create a parallel shadow financial system so that they can do transactions. And China has been crucial for that. I mean, a lot of the foreign companies are in Hong Kong. For China, it's even more important because they don't want to be victims of sanctions like Putin was. And so Iran provides basically a laboratory to test out which financial channel can be useful if a crisis takes place. And so for all these reasons, I also discussed in one of my articles the importance of the Red Sea. But yes, in a nutshell, there's an economic aspect, social, but also political.
Though in practice, we've seen China's support for Iran since the beginning of Operation Epic Fury and Roaring Lion has been limited. I mean, we've seen a few declarations, I think, but nothing more substantive than that.
Yeah.
Which also might be apparently why the United States, if I understand correctly, is still allowing oil from Iran to flow through the Strait of Hormuz to reach China, perhaps in the hope that China sort of stays on the sidelines.
Yeah, but I don't think that, you know, not allowing or allowing the oil would change China's position, precisely because they actually also need Gulf countries. They didn't want to rush and say that they condemn the Israeli-U.S. strikes. They were really waiting and seeing what would happen. And what happened was that basically Bahrain presented a resolution condemning Iran. And it's after that China publicly said that they condemn Iranian aggression against Gulf countries. Gulf countries are also super important. They're important because there's a dependency there for China on energy, but also because they have capital that can be extremely important for China, for its economy. So Gulf countries, I think they play a big role. I don't think China would want to alienate them.
How would you characterize the role that China has been playing in this war, if any, and sort of its responses so far, other than condemning the Iranian attacks on Gulf countries?
Well, I think from what I've seen, discussions on China, especially by Chinese experts and some others, I think that they are in a wait and see mode. Why? Because if this operation succeeds, it means that they will have to rethink their strategy and their position in the Middle East that relied heavily on Iran so that they can make and broker deals. For example, that's true thanks to Iran that Saudi Arabia normalized with Iran in Beijing, and Beijing took advantage of that. In fact, Beijing also played a role by having Fatah and Hamas in Beijing trying to normalize and have some sort of agreement. So Iran is very important for their diplomatic work, and they will have to rethink that if this operation succeeds. And so I think they are in a wait and see position. They are if this operation fails, it means that they made a very good decision by just condemning the Iranian aggression and just staying on the line, waiting for that, and then, you know, afterwards explain how the United States is in decline and how Israel is not a great ally, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they are, as always, playing a balancing act.
But I think this war is about China also in another sense, which is that there's been arguments made by some people in the maybe in the restrainer camp or the isolationist camp, or really people in the United States who I would say are focused very, you know, almost entirely on China. And the argument is that a war in Iran requires the movement of assets, the use of munitions, the use of capabilities, and that diverts them from the Indo-Pacific to the Middle East. And my response to that in my conversations also with various policymakers and with the various analysts is that, in fact, the war in Iran, if it's successful and if all of the goals that the United States and Israel have set out for themselves are successful, that will allow the true pivot to the Indo-Pacific, to China. Iran is what empowered Hamas to carry out the October 7th attack, which led to the seven-front regional war. Time and time again, Iran and its proxies draw the U.S. or force the U.S. attention or resources into wars involving Hezbollah and Israel, the Houthis attacking global shipping. With Iran, the Iranian regime gone or greatly weakened, the United States can gradually move more and more of its attention to the Indo-Pacific, which I actually think also might be one of the reasons that China has invested quite a lot in Iran's military, because they understood that as long as they kept propping up Iran and empowering and strengthening Iran, Iran could keep the U.S. further tied down in the Middle East.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I wrote along those lines as well, because at the end of the day, Iran is an imminent threat. I mean, there was a threshold when it comes to understanding how their missiles were being developed to the point where if we wait just a year from now, it'll be very hard to penetrate their system. And it's a very different thing than to say that this operation just happened for the sake of it. I think it happened because a threshold was crossed. The Israelis have been fighting against Iran's proxies for a very long time. They've been weakened. Hezbollah has been weakened. They're no longer in Syria. The Houthis have doubts about whether to fortify the relationship with Iran or not. So there are different signals that just show that if the United States just gets to the work and makes that very successful with Israel, then it will have much more political bandwidth, military and also economic tools that it can help, that it can absolutely help when we're thinking about the Indo-Pacific and what is at play there. So I definitely agree about on this.
So on a different topic, Asher and I were talking in our intro about some of the bizarre online like conspiracy theories about this war and people basically pretending that the winning side is losing and the losing side is winning, which brings me to your idea of third worldism, which I would say pretending that the winners lost and the losers won would be part of third worldism. But could you explain what you mean by third worldism?
It's very funny. There was this very good, actually, piece in the New York Times about how there are a lot of these videos and fake AI videos just showing how things are blowing up when they're not. I wrote about third worldism, I think, earlier this year, but it was just a realization that there's just a school of thought that just thinks that, you know, America is a colonial empire, absolutely evil one, and Israel is a proxy of that very empire. Sometimes it is the empire itself, and that everything that happens in the Middle East needs to be seen through the lens of American power, and that it is, and that America is the only player to blame for everything that goes wrong in the Middle East. And nothing for that goes right. nothing that goes right is America's achievement. And it's very prevalent. And it has been prevalent for years, though, especially like since the 60s, Soviet propaganda, later on, Pan-Arabism, Marxist-Leninist groups.
Become shockingly prevalent among Americans lately, I feel like. I've been living in Israel for more than 20 years now, but I still lived in America when the Iraq War started. And you had like a few crazies, but like it was not like this.
It's very disturbing because I do read a lot of Arab media and also Iranian media. And sometimes they, you can see how sometimes when you talk to someone and they tell you about a conspiracy, you just feel like you're just reading from the same sources and that it's a foreign concept, basically. I think it also reveals something about basically the education system as well, because it's very, very attractive and very easy to say that everything is black or white. The Middle East is very difficult and complex. And America is not the only player. There's China and Russia, and there are other countries as well, and Gulf countries. Sometimes they fight each other. Israel, within the Israeli system, different political parties saying different things. And so it's very hard to actually present a black and white picture. But because I think the appeal to do so, there is a huge appeal to do so. I think third worldism becomes a shortcut. But yeah, they're on top of third worldism. Yeah, I've seen the conspiracy theories, and it's quite scary, actually.
Oh, there are plenty of conspiracy theories, I think, in the U.S. as well. I mean, right now there's a very popular conspiracy theory that sort of Israel tricked, just like Israel tricked George Bush Jr. into invading Iraq in 2003, Israel has now tricked President Trump into launching his strikes against Iran. We saw the director of counterterrorism, I think, make that accusation in a letter that he wrote today, that he released today when he resigned. We're not going to sort of refight that whole debate here over 2003, but I think it's fairly well established that both Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and the head of the Mossad, Meir Dagan, the head of military intelligence, and others conveyed to the Americans multiple times their reservations about the Iraq war for various reasons. One, because they didn't believe in this whole building democracy project. Also, because they thought that the real threat was Iran. Israel and America should not get bogged down in Iraq. I mean, imagine if we had dealt with Iran back in 2002, 2003, how much bloodshed and wars and turmoils in the Middle East might have been saved. But the bottom line is that the idea that because Israel was so clever that it was able to trick two American presidents into launching wars and ignoring the entire process, and I think also, frankly, portraying the American presidents as sort of gullible dupes, is, I think, a very potent modern-day conspiracy theory as well.
I think you did a great overview of all of that. But also there is, I think there is also a really big distrust in institutions in the United States. And it has been the case since COVID and a little bit way before. They engaged in absolute ideological crusades and dogmatic view of things. So obviously people turned against that, went to podcasters hoping that they would be much more nuanced and informative. Well, it turned out that they became all conspiracist theories, and because at the end of the day, they also are interested in having more views, having more a bigger audience, and it's much more appealing to say that these things are happening because of aliens than to say that it's happening because Iran has missiles, and it's a. There is also something going on there, purely capitalistic. But yes, there is also this huge distrust, honestly, in institutions, and they're not helping either. You can see that in how this war has been portrayed. I mean, the military gains are absolutely enormous. We're talking about 5,000 targets. And it's, I think, week 3. And the success has been enormous. And they don't even report that. There's always something, oh, an intelligence leak from an unknown source. Who is the source? We actually don't know. And so there is, I think, a huge problem across the board.
So maybe on a more optimistic note, let's talk Abraham Accords. You've called for an Abraham Accords 2.0. What would that look like?
Well, I think that it means that elevating what the current Abraham Accords are to something bigger and wider that basically incorporates the security aspect more and more, more intelligence sharing. Why not expanding the Accords? Because I think, this operation is entirely a U.S.-Israel operation from beginning to end. Every single target is being shared. Gulf countries are collaborating under CENTCOM. So there is something there, a framework that can be expanded to make sure that they can handle threats in the future by themselves, by better coordination. The United States does not have, to be there all the time. I think this is what this operation revealed so far, that there is a huge opportunity. And it's really a matter of exploiting it, And I think that as things stand, every single country that normalized with Israel understands why that was necessary with Iran as a neighbor.
I think it's a really good point. And it goes back to also what we talked about the Indo-Pacific, because if the U.S. wants to pivot to China, it's important for U.S. partners and allies, all of its CENTCOM partners, to be able to work more closely together in defending their region from extremist governments, from extremist nations, from extremist terrorist groups, whether they're Sunni, whether they're Shia. And there has been this vision of a Middle East strategic alliance or a Middle East air defense. And I think that following the cooperation we've seen, obviously between Israel and the U.S., between the U.S. and all the Gulf countries, but I think between Israel and the Gulf countries as well, though it's not all been reported, I think there is a lot of opportunity to take that to the next step. I've also heard from various people involved in regional shipping, regional transport, that there's increasing interest in the India, Middle East, Europe corridor, given the disruptions to shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. We're actually about a little more than 5 years past the three-way agreement between U.S., Israel, and Morocco, which led to the reestablishment of relations between those three countries. Miskav Institute Chair Meir Ben-Shabbat actually led the delegation that met with the King of Morocco and signed the agreements on the normalization. Where do things stand, in your view, in terms of Morocco-Israel relations 5 years later and, given all that's happened since October 7th?
Yeah, I think that they are absolutely increasing in terms of trade and also in terms of exchanges and industrial cooperation, mainly defense, security. I think all of these things, I think Morocco and Israel have been working on in a way that is simply unprecedented. Also, Morocco has a huge Moroccan Jewish diaspora, especially in Israel. And so there is an interest, an organic one, to maintain those ties and to make them better and bigger. That I would say. Also, going back to Lahav's question, if there is one thing that I think this operation revealed, is that Iran no longer has the monopoly over the Palestinian question, over the Gaza question, over every single Muslim question. They really, I think, spent a lot of capital into making themselves absolutely necessary to every single question that shapes the region. And it was very interesting to see how, while the United States and Israel were attacking Iran, there were no manifestations outside. You didn't see images of Muslims across the board basically calling a resistance against the Zionist entity or something. It didn't happen. I think that people underestimate how important that is for the Islamic Republic, because it's a revolutionary regime. So every single military operation they do needs to have a psychological effect. And I think they spent it. It's just not attractive anymore. Being part of Hezbollah militias is just not it. Especially as Middle Easterners are getting much more connected, much more, much more interested in taking part of their society. And it's the case in Morocco as well. People are much more focused on, you know, how can I build a business? How can I help investments here and there? The country is really accelerating its economic development. People are expected to respond to that rather than being the obstacle to it. And these ideologies are just no longer attractive. It's very funny because now they're more attractive in the West than in the East. I mean, it's sad.
But I think something that not a lot of people paid attention to when President Trump convened the Board of Peace in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago, and the representative of each country spoke, I believe it was the Moroccan foreign minister, Nasser Bourita. He said that what Morocco could contribute, he was the only one who talked, or the Moroccan representative was the only one who talked about de-radicalization and about the need to de-radicalize Gaza and how Morocco could contribute to that process because of its heritage of Muslim-Jewish dialogue and coexistence. Wasn't always golden, but there certainly is a long and strong tradition of Jewish-Moroccan coexistence, and that they could contribute to that also potentially in Gaza as well. But so I do want to sort of push a little bit. We have seen protests in Morocco during the Gaza war. We've seen very negative media coverage. We have seen business deals continue, investment continue. Where do things stand now in terms of Moroccan-Israel relations? And is there still enough, I guess, base of public support, do you think, for restarting positive momentum now that we've had a ceasefire in Gaza?
Yeah, well, there's definitely, you will always see, I think, manifestations and all of these things, because it's just part of the political discussions, you know, to taint a government a certain way and the other in a way. But I can tell you that from, you know, talking to the population, Morocco gets attacked all the time for having ties to Israel. The Moroccans are feeling that as well, Israel has never collaborated with terrorists that would tear the country apart, contrary to a lot of other Muslim and Arab countries. So there's that, I think. Obviously, it will take some time.
By the way, if the Iranian regime falls and it's no longer it and Hezbollah are no longer supporting the Polisario, that would be very important for Morocco as well.
Yeah, and people are paying attention to this much more and it's becoming much more part of the discussion. On your comments on the de-radicalization, I completely agree with you. Morocco has a huge soft power, I would say, program. They train imams and, under a Sufi Maliki tradition, much more tolerant towards women and other things. Because at the end of the day, in Morocco, the value of Islam is really the value of knowledge, you know, thinking and studying. That's what is really in the Moroccan, I think, psyche important. And in fact, I always think of writing that, but there's also a huge Jewish tradition in Morocco that contributed to that. A lot of Jewish scholars in Morocco who shaped that thinking as well. So there are a lot of imams that get trained, get sent to West Africa because there's a lot of jihadi activity there. And the best way to counter it is to also be active and to suggest an alternative. And the alternative, it's to simply not be a radical, contribute better to your community in a way that reflects on you and your family. And there are other ways to do that. And yeah, it's a very important point. I think that Morocco is very adamant to play that role in Gaza as well.
As somebody who has a very, I appreciate your very broad perspective, looking not just at the Middle East, but also the role of China, the role of Russia, the dynamics with Turkey and with the United States. Can you think of a sort of a black swan event, something that could have really deep impact on the Middle East over the next year, which people aren't thinking about. You know, sort of an unknown that people should be thinking about and taking into consideration.
Black Swan event. I think the biggest one in my mind is not in the Middle East. If I can, it's actually in West Africa. There is a huge Al-Qaeda group expanding there. And it's even more dangerous because it's on Europe's southern borders. And they have not been able to tackle it. And I think Morocco alone cannot do a lot because it needs a lot of help. It's a huge group that needs to be disarmed and tackled. And I am really afraid that they're going to expand dramatically, take over Burkina Faso or more of Mali's territory. If they succeed, that would be very problematic. I think this administration is doing its best when it comes to reaching out to these countries, but you never know. It's a big problem.
Absolutely. In fact, I actually wrote in a piece together with one of our senior fellows here at MISCAV, Ronen Levi Maoz, who was Director General of Israel's Foreign Ministry, about the Sahel and about the danger of sort of America and France pulling out of this vastly important region, you know, from Sudan to Mauritania and Russia and China and Iran and Turkey coming in, and then all these various Al-Qaeda and extremist groups also, which could destabilize the both below them and above them, Egypt, Libya, and that also reaches Europe. We saw the Biden administration giving a cold shoulder to the current Sudanese government following the revolution, and that led to this terrible civil war in Sudan. It's very hard to know what will happen there, but it would be fantastic if we could bring Sudan back into the orbit of the Abraham Accords. So definitely the Sahel is a critical region that affects Europe and the United States and Israel in a very, very meaningful way.
Yeah, I actually do watch the Sahel closely, and yeah, I've seen things on Libya as well. You don't know what might happen. There are also reports, as we're talking about, a problem between Ethiopia and Eritrea, even more dramatic when we think about the civil war in Sudan. So there are enough problems to actually cause a black swan event. I think as this operation continues, hopefully it will have the military, we will see some major military gains. I think it can really shape the region in a very positive way to help Americans basically create a new security order where Israel can integrate better with its neighbors can also benefit from Israeli technology, biotech, agriculture. I think there's a lot of benefits. Hopefully it will stay that way.
Do you think that the war in Iran will encourage more of these countries to have relations with Israel because they see how Israel is, you know, willing to stand up to enemies, not only of Israel, but of many other countries in the region, and also just their military superiority? You think that that's where that's going?
Yeah, definitely. But also there are other projects. Asher mentioned the India-Middle East corridor. It basically didn't happen because of the Iranian veto, obviously not very visible, but, you know, Saudis and Israelis no longer discussing or collaborating. There was this discussion about normalization, never happened. Well, now there is, I think, an opportunity since Israelis contributed dramatically to intercepting every missile and drone. I think that on these projects, we will see some progress.
Great, Zineb. Thank you so much for joining Mideast Horizons. If people want to follow you online and social media, what's the best place for them to follow you?
It's at ZRibua, and my website is zinebribua.com.
It's called Beyond Ideology, your Substack,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Beyond the Ideological.
Why? What does that mean, Beyond
Honestly,
Ideology?
I actually created that website as a Substack, really just blogging, because I just like to read literature and philosophy. And then, obviously, my work is on foreign policy, so I just started publishing things here and there. And I thought, you know, just keep the title because you know, I try to look at things a little bit beyond, you know, on the conservative or the left-wing side, just really as they are. So yes, this is how it started.
Well, I highly recommend everybody to check it out. Nineve, I've really enjoyed following you and found your insights really helpful. So I look forward to continuing to be in touch.
Thank you. Thank you. Really appreciate it. And thank you again, Lahav and Asher, for the kind invitation.
Yeah, thanks for being here. This was really interesting. Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on all different social media, X, Instagram, etc. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We love to hear from you, and we'll be back next week.